Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 13th. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing, making beer at home. With this week, we wrap up our coverage from the Great American Beer Festival. We talk about American Wild Ales with Vinny Chilurzo from Russian River Brewing Company, an innovator in the field. We also talk about meads with Redstone Meadery's chairman of the mead, David Myers. And Ray Daniels from the Brewers Association talks about a new recipe to celebrate an old fan of beer, Ben Franklin. But first, let's take a peek in the mailbag. If you'll remember this past week, Fred from Apex, North Carolina wrote in to say he's seen judges at homebrew competitions smoking cigars between rounds, and Fred wondered how that affected the judges' taste buds. Well, I forwarded Fred's question to our expert on taste, Dr. Scott Hernes of Ohio State University, and he had this to say. Scott says, I would agree that smoking a cigar between rounds would be a bad idea. A good judge, I would think, would want to take some steps to keep his or her palate clean between rounds. For example, water rinses. The trigeminal nervous system in the oral cavity is picking up signals such as carbonation and alcohol content. Bitter stimuli are detected by the gustatory nerves. The long-lasting effects on the oral cavity by cigar smoke would certainly interfere with the ability of these systems to detect their stimuli so that subtleties could easily be lost. Likely that for these judges, beer and cigars just go together so well they can't imagine one without the other. But Scott says, I'd say, wait on the smoke till your job's done. It certainly isn't making the task at hand easier. Well, there you go. Official word from the good doctor. Evan from Knoxville, Tennessee says, I just wanted to thank you for a great podcast. Well, thank you, Evan. I've been brewing since last Christmas and just brewed my fifth batch of pumpkin ale for the holiday season ahead. It's in the secondary now, and I'll bottle it in another week. I just converted an old refrigerator into a kegerator, and I kegged my fourth batch. He says, Evan says, let me tell you, there's nothing quite like walking into the garage and pouring yourself a nice draft beer after a long day at work. Well, Evan, I'm jealous. Jealous of the kegerator, and your pumpkin ale sounds good and timely. If you're interested in commercial examples of pumpkin ale, the guys over at Craft Beer Radio recently reviewed a few of them, and you can find that show at craftbeerradio.com. Mike from Wallkill, New York, writes to say he's pretty new to homebrewing and wonders about using the dishwasher to sanitize his bottles. Now, we've talked about this before a bit, and it's interesting to note that when I first read Mike's email, I had just loaded up my dishwasher with bottles to bottle a California Common this past weekend. You can use your dishwasher to sanitize your bottles. Just make sure they're clean going in, and don't use soap or detergent. It's the heat that will do the trick. Put the machine on the heavy setting with high heat and the heated drying cycle, and the bottles will be a little too hot to handle at the end. In fact, you want to make sure you let them cool down a bit before you put the beer in there, because you don't want to risk killing the yeast that's going to bottle condition your beer. Now, some prefer to put a bit of sanitizing solution in there with the bottles, but I don't. And some don't like using the dishwasher at all, because they say any rinse aid that might be in there might harm head retention of the beer. But I think we've used a rinse aid in the past. We don't now for some reason. And I didn't have any problems then. But your mileage may vary. Garrett from Bowie, Texas, or is it Bowie, Texas, writes in to say, I'm just getting started in homebrewing. In fact, I have yet to make my first batch. I just found your podcast and really enjoy it. Well, thanks, Garrett. I find the information informative and in a format that is easy to enjoy and understand. My question is, what resources, books, magazines, websites, etc., would you recommend to someone just getting started? Well, if I can slip into a shameless self-promotion mode for just a moment, I think the DVD that Steve Wilkes and I put together is a very good resource for those who are wanting to get into home brewing. You can see clips of that video and find more information at basicbrewing.com. And there's a special hidden offer for listeners to the podcast at basicbrewing.com/special if you're interested. That's basicbrewing.com/special for a special discount for podcast listeners. Also, we've struck up a relationship recently with Brew Your Own magazine, which is another great resource for homebrewers. In fact, if you click on the banner ad on basicbrewingradio.com, you can get a free issue of the magazine. And if you decide to subscribe after reading that first issue, you'll be helping to support this podcast. Zymergy is another great magazine. It's published by the Brewers Association, and a subscription comes with membership in the American Homebrewers Association. Go to beertown.org for more information on Zymergy. Of course, Charlie Papazian's Joy of Homebrewing book is how I got started homebrewing. I believe it's been recently updated. Also, John Palmer has a good book on the subject called How to Brew. In fact, if you go to howtobrew.com, you can read the whole first edition of the book online for free. For advanced brewing, I recommend Ray Daniels' Designing Great Beers. There are lots of resources out there, but I think those are some good ones to get you started. You may remember Eric from Minneapolis, who wrote in a couple of weeks ago to ask whether he should buy the wort chiller or the bigger pot. Well, Eric wrote in to say, after hearing everybody's advice, that he bought both, an 8-gallon pot and an immersion chiller. He tried it out on a winter warmer. Eric says he was a little nervous about using the new setup, but he relaxed, and he had a homebrew. That's way to go, Eric. Congratulations. Eric says he thinks a good topic for the show would be brewing software. What's out there, and how do you use it? I think that's a great idea. I use a couple of programs, one for my PC and one for my Palm PDA. It'd be interesting if we could find out some information as well for software for the Macintosh, which I'm quite partial to. We could talk about those and what others use too. If you want to let us know what software you use for your brewing, shoot me an email at james@basicbrewing.com or use the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. Last week, Greg from Hawaii wrote in to ask what he should brew to go along with the warm temperatures where he lives there in paradise. The issue that Greg has to deal with, of course, is fermentation temperature, and I talked about some options that I had heard of and asked for your input. Well, Nick from Boynton Beach, Florida, another warm place, says, I live in southern Florida, so it can be quite a challenge sometimes. I do have a fridge that with modification can fit 6 cornies, or Cornelius kegs, and I also have an external thermostat so I can raise the temp if I need to, mostly for lagers. For my ales, I ferment outside in a cooler with 1 to 2 gallons of ice in frozen milk jugs sitting next to the carboys. I wrap the opening with a beach towel so no light or warm air gets in, and the temperature is usually in the low to mid-60s, even in the heat of summer. I change the ice once a day. I only change the ice once a day. I've even lagered a Pilsner this way, just using 3 gallons of ice. So there we go. There's someone using some of the techniques we talked about last time. Nick from Boynton Beach, Florida. Appreciate the input. Alex writes in from Massachusetts, but he says he's originally from Montreal, and Alex likes to go by the handle Alex, which I think is a cool beer name. Alex says, Montreal may not be at all like Hawaii, but we do have very warm summers and few air conditioning systems. The tricks you gave do help to bring or keep the temperature down, but it's also true that some yeast strains and beer styles are more suited for high temperatures. Why yeasts Ardennes yeast, that's A-R-D-E-N-N-E-S, is one of the highest rated ones for optimal temperature. Have used it at very high temperatures to nice results. The esters produced by this yeast are closer to spices than to fruits and give the beer an interesting and complex profile at high temperatures. High-gravity beers fermented at high temperatures are more likely to produce fusel alcohols, which can give you headaches. It might be a good idea not to brew too heavy a beer at very high temperature. Still, several Belgian-style beers and associated yeasts can tolerate rather high temperatures. While there are more risks of contamination at higher temperatures, Alex continues, this can in fact make for interesting experiments with lambic-like and other sour beers. The wild yeast strains and bacteria in those blends seem quite happy to work at higher temperatures. For instance, some brewers have good results with Roselaire making Flemish Red and Oud Bruin at rather high temperature. Of course, not everyone likes sour beer, but it can be an interesting avenue for experimentation. Good thoughts there, and we'll talk a little bit more about the wild beers and the sour beers in the show. Brendan from Lincoln, Nebraska has good advice for those of us with four seasons. He recommends brewing with the weather. He says cooler fermented ales in winter and warmly fermented Belgians in summer. Living in Nebraska, my not-so-finished basement gets in the 50s in the winter and 80s in the summer. I fermented Belgian-style ales into the 80s. Vit and Belgian ale yeasts from White Labs and Y Yeast. I've used the tub/frozen water bottle method successfully to reduce the temperature, the fermentation temperature, by 5 degrees or more. Also, it's important to remember that fermentation temperature will be 5, maybe 10 degrees Fahrenheit more than ambient temps. It's interesting. It's an interesting point. The fermentation process actually increases the temperature in itself. A lot of that heat rises through the airlock and goes through the sides of the fermenter, but it's an interesting point to keep in mind. Well, there you go. Once again, great advice from our listeners, and I appreciate the input greatly, and I know that everyone else does too. Well, now, on to our coverage of the Great American Beer Festival. Andy Sparks and I headed out to Denver a couple of weeks ago. You heard the first part of our wrap-up last week. Now, here's part two, as Andy and I talked in the hotel room on our last day in Denver.
Well, another talking about styles that were popular at the festival, the sour beers, which I had not had before. The first beer that I tasted at the Brewer Supply Group was a New Belgium La Folie, which is unfortunately only available at the brewery. But it's a very sour beer, and would you say that it would be one of these beers that fits into the proposed new category of American wild ales?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of these wild American wild ales coming on the scene, which are in some ways reminiscent of some of the Belgian styles, the lambics and so forth. But they're trying very hard not to say that these are Belgian beers, because they really are American innovations. They use some of the same processes to make the beer sour, but they're not copies of Belgian beers. They really are unique, brand new beers that these guys are coming up with. Very interesting, complex recipes.
And the sourness, really, if you're not expecting it, if you're expecting it to be just a regular beer, you're going to be in for a shock, because it the nose and the taste are quite powerful in some of these, especially the La Folie was really, it was almost like, it reminded me of kind of a sour cheese, you know. It was very, you know, I guess they used the bacteria in the...
Very pungent.
Yeah. But there were also other examples of that. Dogfish Head had a peachy sour beer. There was the Pizza Port. It was another that had a sour beer there. There were, you know, a lot all over the place. But one that was one of, if not my favorites, was from the Russian River Brewing Company called Supplication. We were lucky enough to meet up with Vinny Cherlurzo, and I'm sure I'm just massacring his last name, and I apologize, Vinny, if you're listening. Maybe we can talk, do another interview, and you can help me out. But Vinny, with the Russian River Brewing Company, has a background in home brewing and has the entrepreneurial spirit, and has a creative approach to brewing. And we had a conversation with him, and here's what he had to say. So, Vinny, you were just saying that you have a history in home brewing. It's kind of close to your heart.
Yeah, I started home brewing when I was 18 years old. Kind of like to think that I beat the system and that I was able to buy ingredients, but, you know, make my own beer, although I wasn't 21. But I grew up in a winery, so my parents were very liberal about my sister and I tasting wine. And we drank, you know, the saying in the wine industry is it takes a lot of great beer to make great wine, but or it takes a lot of beer, because the beer probably wasn't that great. We were drinking Lucky Lager and, you know, that sort of thing, and Henry Weinhardt's, but, you know, okay regional beer.
So does home brewing and home brewing so young and in an environment like a winery influence your career?
And I got into home brewing and brewing professionally more so because I like the idea that you can make beer in 21 days or so for an ale. And there's a lot of irony there to that now because now we're making these, you know, wild ales, these American wild ales, as I talked about earlier in the conference, that, you know, these things are taking 12 to 18 months to make. So it's totally come full circle that, you know, I left winemaking because I was impatient, you know, typical American, you want to do everything fast. And then, you know, now we're making beers that are taking a year to a year and a half, 2 years even to make. So it's come full circle. But the fact that we use barrels in the wild ales we do, the Temptation, the Supplication, we've got beers aging right now that are old La Folie barrels from New Belgium. We've got a beer that we're doing using a fruit called a Pluot, which is a cross between a plum and an apricot. Another one with Muscat Canale grapes. The Supplication has cherries. We're doing a collaborative beer in a barrel with 21st Amendment Brewery in San Francisco that they make a watermelon beer. And I always joke with Sean, the owner, that, you know, we need to give this beer some funk and a little more personality. So I had him bring up three or four kegs, and we stuck it in a barrel and added a bunch of Brett. And when I get back, we're going to add lactobacillus. And, so anyways, the point is that all the winemaking background and understanding oak and understanding, you know, what flavor the barrels can add. In the case of Temptation, it's Chardonnay barrels, and Supplication, it's you know, a Pinot Noir barrel, and how those flavors marry. And I think a lot of my background in winemaking has helped for that.
Now you mentioned Brett. Talk about using, you know, non-traditional fermentation techniques, and how maybe homebrewers can get into that as well.
Well, there's 3 points there: the actual Brett itself, the wood, and then the sugar, the other fermentables. And
now, what is Brett?
And Brettanomyces is a wild yeast. It's an oxidizing wine yeast that works at a very slow pace. It can be done in stainless steel or wood. It doesn't have to be in barrels. A classic example of all stainless steel Brett beers, Orval, from the Trappist Brewery in Belgium. So the Brett itself is the catalyst, is the yeast. It ferments very slow. It throws off very unique flavors of, they're very hard to describe, but earthy, leathery. The harder to describe is barnyard. The best description was wet dog in a phone booth, whatever that meant that someone made. So that's the actual ingredient. Barrels are very hard to come by for home brewers. Mm-hmm. And one reason why you would use barrels is that you would get some oak flavor in it, and you maybe even contribute certain flavors that were in the wood before. In the case of two of our beers, one's a white wine Chardonnay, one's a red wine Pinot, so we're extracting those flavors through the barrel aging. This is a year-long process. Now, I'm a firm believer in home brewing. That's how I got started. One of the new programs we just started was our small barrel lot program for home brewers, and we're purchasing little 5 and 8 gallon barrels, and then we're running damnation in it right now, and we're putting the beer in these new barrels, and we're trying to strip the oak flavor out of it, because if a home brewer were to buy this 8 gallon barrel and make a Brett beer and put it in there for a year, it'd have way too much oak. So what we're doing is developing a new beer that's an oak aged beer, no Brett, nothing weird or funky to it, but we're stripping the oak out of it, and in time we're going to inoculate these barrels with Brettanomyces, the wild yeast, Lactobacillus, and Pediococcus, which are bacteria possibly, and then resell these back to sell them to a home brewer so that they have the ability to use barrels in a barrel age program. So really the whole program we developed was built for the home brewer to be able to buy barrels from us that we've already used. It's going to take some time to develop this because, you know, we need to strip the wood flavor out of the barrels, but in time, homebrewers will be able to buy little barrels that are sizable for them. One of the reasons why you would use barrels aside from getting oak flavor is that Brettanomyces is an oxidizing yeast, so it will work better with a little bit of oxygen diffusion, oxygen getting through the wood and oxidizing just like a wine would, and you will get stronger Brett flavor with that. And one of the things that we have to deal with is when we get used wine barrels, if they're pitched with tartrates, which is the part of wine that wine throws in the stainless steel or a barrel, if the barrels are totally enclosed and you can't get any air diffusion, you do throw some off flavors. And then the third point that I mentioned was alternative sugars. So, you know, not just going with your traditional maltose, or even if you're adding sucrose or dextrose, just regular sugar that, you know, that you can buy from the homebrew store, or the maltose from the malt fermentation itself. I mean, those are all good sugars, but think about adding secondary sugars like honey, fruit, any kind of fruit, those sort of things, raisins, prunes, dates, currants, all those things are going to give a different, slightly different flavor profile with the bread eating those sugars. So secondary sugars are really fun to deal with and think about.
So what's this going to do to, beer contests and competitions, when you've got all these beers that, are breaking all the rules, and are you just going to have one bucket category called American Wild Ales and throw them all in there?
I think that's probably the way it would end up. In truth, a person or brewer that's making these beers, whether they're home brewers or professional, truly probably don't care whether they win an award, and because they're making these beers for themselves, the great flavor profile for their own taste. From a home brewer standpoint, I think that's why you brew as a home brewer, because you want to do stuff for yourself. From a professional standpoint, or from a home brewer standpoint, you can't categorize all these things. There's always going to be someone doing something crazy. Right now, I suppose, ourselves and Pete Support and, a couple others in the country are really on the cutting edge of using, wild yeasts and bacterias and that sort of thing, and using non-traditional ingredients and doing weird things to these things, like, Tommy Arthur at Pete Support roasts his raisins in one of his saisons that he adds, so it gives a more caramelized quality to it. So there isn't an answer to that other than you just are going to have a lot of different crazy beers. And what we hope is that Belgian beers stay Belgian beers, and you can a sour, beer would be entered in a sour category. But when you start throwing in a lot more crazy ideas, it is what it is, and you just run with it.
It's all about personal expression, in a way, right?
It is, and this is really where the artistic side of brewing comes out more than a scientific standpoint. And I don't claim to be a technical brewer. I'm very much of an artistic brewer, and I think those that are making these beers, probably, at least those that are creating the recipes, have a very artistic side to the way that they create and write their recipes. So, and some of the things happen on accident too. So, and that's okay too. The end product is, if it's good, that's what counts, whether it's professional or an amateur homebrewer.
And again, it was nice for Vinny to take time to talk to us, and also very nice to hear from a professional brewer that is keeping home brewers in mind, and developing the program with the barrels, really kind of bringing home brewers along in these new styles and helping them develop their craft as well.
Yeah, it's really nice to see that they seem to really care about the home brewer, and it sounds like they want to help the home brewers start to experiment with this new American Wild Ale style. We also got to meet Rob Todd from Allagash Brewing. He's the brewmaster there, and they're also brewing wild ales as well. And one of the things they did point out was that some of the things in the wild yeasts and bacteria that they use to create these wild ales are kind of hard to control, and so you want to be careful and use them sparingly, and also pay a lot of attention to sanitation issues, because this can get into all your equipment, and then you will always make wild ales from then on.
Right. Vinny was quoting someone else, saying that these kind of wild yeasts are, if regular standard yeasts are like dogs, they'll come when you call and they'll do what you ask them to.
Easily trained.
Yeah, exactly. These new, or maybe not new yeasts, but these wild yeasts are kind of like cats.
Yeah, especially the Brettromyces, which is the one they use a lot of times. You'll hear that abbreviated as simply Brett in the beer styles or in the discussion of the beer. But they said yes, that it's a difficult yeast to control. That it is technically a yeast. But it's hard to get it to work. It needs a lot of attention, and then it can get out of control very easily. So you want to be careful with that. And but you can get those yeasts from your local home brew shop. If they don't have them, they can probably order them through Y Yeast or White Labs Yeasty. Both of them carry some of these unique yeast styles.
And you might want to try to find one of these sour beers and taste it before you brew a batch, because you know you might not like it.
Right, but along those same lines, the first one you try maybe you won't like, because it might be very, very sour. But go ahead and keep trying them. I was not a big sour fan. I really wouldn't say that I am a big sour beer fan, but I definitely had some that I liked a lot. So I would, you know, be adventurous. If you don't like the first one you try, keep trying them. And kind of keep an open mind to this style. I think it's one that we'll hear more and more about.
Well, one style that, it's not even a beer, but one thing that we've talked about on this show in the past, and one that keeps coming up in emails from listeners, is mead. Redstone Meadery had a tasting, mainly for the media, of different meads, not only from them, but from other meaderies in the area, and they're also promoting an event coming up. And we had a chance to talk to David Myers from Redstone, and he calls himself the chairman of the mead.
Well, this is actually our Get Back to Your Roots party, because, of course, we're here at the Great American Beer Festival, and we like to remind the brewers exactly where they came from in the alcohol chain, and mead being the first alcoholic beverage predates grape wine and beer by several thousand years. So we figure this is a great time to set out a whole bunch of Redstone products, as well as meads from the International Mead Festival. So this is truly a mead education party, and what better group than craft brewers from around the United States to do it with?
Now we've got homebrewers in our audience who not only do beer, but do mead as well. And this is really a demonstration of how versatile mead is. We've got lots of different types in here, don't we?
And that's exactly the point of what we're trying to do here is, people think of mead as a singular beverage. They think of it as a big, sweet, heavy dessert wine. But, of course, mead can taste like anything you want it to taste like, and I agree. There's a wonderfully diverse catalog of meads here. Several meads are not actually even available in the United States, which is so much fun about the International Mead Festival, which will be February 10th and 11th in 2006. So it's Valentine's Day weekend, so we encourage people to come out and do their honey and enjoy a bunch of meads from around the world. Last year we had 85 meads from 32 different companies representing seven countries as far away as Australia and New Zealand.
Wow, and where can people find out more about that?
They can go to meadfest.com, or they can always check out our website at redstonemeadery.com, where they're proud host of the event, and really are out there beating the drum for mead in general, and we're loving life.
Talk a bit about the variety that we've got in there. What kinds of meads are we sampling today?
Well, certainly our product lines at Redstone are actually widely diverse, and we're very proud of both our qualities as well as our diversity. We have a nectar product line that's 8% alcohol and carbonated, so it's kind of light, crisp, and refreshing. We also have a 12% alcohol non-carbonated, very wine-like, as well as our reserve product line, which is the big giant, it is actually the big giant dessert mead that you know we make once a year, different flavor every year, and strictly ready when I say it is. But we have meads that are dry, we have fruited meads, we have spice meads, we have tej, which are Ethiopian meads, in there. And so it is this wonderfully diverse grouping from dry to sweet, sparkling to still, high in alcohol and low in alcohol. And that's what we're really trying to preach to people is, well, mead is wildly diverse.
And spiced and flavored with fruits. And
absolutely. You got metheglins and melomels and piments and sizers and traditionals and varietals and braggots and you name it, and it's in there with meads.
Well, it's a delight to be here. I appreciate your having us.
Oh, it's a lot of fun, and let's go back in and enjoy some mead.
I hear you. I'm with you. We appreciate David taking time with us, and especially appreciate being able to try all the different meads. I mean, what was your... the wide range of how you can use honey in making honey wines and making meads and melomels and sizers and whatever.
The different meads that they had there were so many different kinds. From some sweet meads, the very strong, sticky sweet meads, to the ones that are almost like champagne, some that had flavors in them, fruit flavors, some that had spices. One of my favorite was a vanilla cinnamon mead. I actually got a bottle of it to bring home with me. But there was several types, including some international meads there. If you get a chance, if you haven't tried mead, you need to get some and try it. It's very difficult to find commercially available in the United States. But there are a couple meaderies in the United States, and they would love it if you would go to your local liquor store, restaurant, whatever, and ask for mead and try and get the word out that we'd like to have the ability to try mead where we live.
And if you don't have it where you live, you can do what we do and make it. So, you know, I don't know that my mead comes up to par with what we tasted the other day, but you can make some really good meads at home. And to show our dedication for mead, Andy found a liquor store here in town that had some of the Redstone meads, and we walked quite a distance to get the mead, and we picked up some beer while we were there. Andy?
Yes, James?
This should prove our dedication to good beer.
Yeah, I'd say.
I have 3 6 packs of IPA on my shoulder in a box. What do you got?
I think the same kind of beer in my box, but I have an additional bottle of mead in here as well.
And we've walked how many blocks?
I think 2 of the 400 blocks we have to walk.
We got a long way to walk. There was probably a closer. Well, I don't know if there was a closer place to buy beer, but hey, we got the walk sign here.
And we get to check out Coors Field. It's a pretty nice looking stadium.
Yeah, that's looking nice. I wonder if I'll be conscious by the time we get back to the hotel.
I know I'll be out of breath since I already am.
So we are guys who are dedicated to the beer, getting beer that we can't get at home.
Well, yeah, and that's something that I think all homebrewers can agree on, is that the reason we homebrew is because we love good beer. And so there's no reason not to go out and get a six-pack or two every now and then of your favorite beer, or to try somebody else's beer, because that only helps you know more about the different flavors and the different ways beer styles taste. You know, the pale ales alone run the gamut from, you know, very bitter to slightly sweet and malty. So you want to try a lot of beers, and there's no reason not to go out and support these craft brewers, because they need our support too.
And it'll give you inspiration on how to make your beer better as well. Now, another guy who liked good beers was Benjamin Franklin, and his 300th birthday is coming up soon in January. And the Brewers Association had a contest to find a recipe to celebrate Benjamin Franklin, and they found a recipe to put the label Poor Richard's Ale on, and we talked to Ray Daniels from the Brewers Association about the project.
Well, we started out with a competition. That part's over now. And from here on, it's going to be cooperative and collaborative. Basically, what we did was picked a recipe, which will be called Poor Richard's Ale. And that is a recipe that represents what colonial beer was probably like at the time that Benjamin Franklin was going to the pub and drinking beer himself in the evenings. And we're going to distribute that recipe to brewers all over the country and invite them to participate in brewing that recipe and making it available to consumers in January for the 300th anniversary of Benjamin Franklin's birth.
And what makes it appropriate for the theme?
Well, the sort of beer style is old ale, and I suppose that's appropriate in some sense if you're celebrating the 300th birthday of a particular individual. But also the ingredients of it are appropriate. There's molasses in the beer, and that was a very common brewing element back in colonial times. The other thing that the judges particularly liked about this recipe was that it has flaked corn in it. And corn, of course, is an indigenous American ingredient. And the colonialists are known to have brewed with corn from very early along, back in the 1630, 1640 kind of time period. We have documentation of them brewing with corn, malting corn, doing the things that were necessary to make alcoholic beverages from corn. So it's common that they would have used that ingredient. Also, because it was an indigenous American ingredient, it would have been something that would have allowed them to avoid the costs of importing ingredients from England. And that was certainly a colonial concept at the time. So the judges were really, really pretty psyched about having a beer that had both the molasses and the corn in it, and that's the recipe they went with.
And how would you describe the character of the beer?
It was a very pleasant flavor, very sort of malt-oriented. The molasses has a distinct flavor. There was some discussion amongst the judges and brewers about different types of molasses. I think they were generally trying to avoid blackstrap, which is a very assertive flavor, and it just takes a very small amount to make that flavor evident using other less assertive characteristics, less assertive types of molasses in the recipe. And I don't remember exactly what the spec was on it, but it's a dark but not so dark type of molasses.
And finally, why is it important to come up with a beer recipe to celebrate Benjamin Franklin?
Well, Benjamin Franklin is widely attributed with having authored the quote, "Beer is proof that God loves us and wants to see us happy." And so, of course, that's a great reason to use beer to celebrate Benjamin Franklin's birthday. Later in his life, of course, he spent a lot of time in France, and no doubt he enjoyed wine over there. But ale and beer truly would have been colonial beverages. We didn't have much in the way of grape crops and the ability to produce wine in the United States. Ale was the dominant drink, certainly in England at the time during the 1700s, and would have been the sort of the cultural drink norm for English colonialists in the United States as well. So, yeah, absolutely, it's the beverage that would have been most common amongst colonialists.
And we also Ray and Paul Gatza, who's director of the American Homebrewers Association, were both there at the news conference that we learned about this recipe. And I said, "Hey, do you have a scaled down version of that recipe for homebrewers?" And they both said, "Hey, that's a great idea." So I was kind of surprised that they hadn't thought of that to begin with. So if and when they put out a recipe scale for homebrewers, I will look for it out there and link to it. But it would be really cool to make this Poor Richard's Ale in celebration of Benjamin Franklin's birthday, and we'll have it hopefully have it ready for January. Well, Andy, it's been a blast, and I appreciate your company and your help in covering this event. I feel I'm a little more clued in on how to cover these things, and just on the world of beer. And I appreciate coming along with you.
Well, I had a terrific time with you, James. This is my first Great American Beer Festival. I'm sure it won't be my last, but I, as well as you, think I have a strategy for next time, because this is an awfully big event, probably the biggest beer drinking event in the world. Would probably easily rival some of the German festivals because of the variety that you get to try, and 1,600 beers on the floor. You definitely have to have a strategy for doing it. But I had a wonderful time. I look forward to maybe coming back next year and doing it again.
Great. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, James.
And thanks again to Andy Sparks for all the help. You can visit Andy's homebrew store at thehomebrewery.com. Be sure to check out our pictures from the festival by going to the description of last week's show on basicbrewingradio.com. Well, next week, kegging. Andy joins us again to talk about Cornelius kegs, how to use them, and how to take care of them. So you'll want to join us then. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say hey, write to james@basicbrewing.com or fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And if you're wanting to get into home brewing while you're on our site, you can check out our DVD, Basic Brewing, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. We'll walk you through the process step by step. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVD on the site. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online. Well, that's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time. So long.